Danger. The emergency destruct system is now activated.
Cake and grief counseling will be available at the conclusion of the test.
She's alive! Alive!
Maybe you should put some shorts on or something if you want to keep fighting evil today.
Why not just put a stake through her heart?
She's not a vampire.
Oh, you'd be surprised how many things that'll kill.
We are now seeing the beginnings of another stage of human evolution. At last, we can retire and give up this life of crime.
You and your training wheels.
Hailing frequencies are open.
Hello, sweetie.
Commencing countdown. T-5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show.
All that we hold dear will be shattered by Alia de Bodard.
Yay! I'm Sean.
I'm Julia.
And our special guest is, as you just heard, Alia de Bodard. Hello!
Hey! That is a killer opening line. I should steal it.
It's a good one. It is very good.
Like, disclaimer, please don't actually shatter all that I hold dear. I would prefer not.
Yeah, most people get pissed.
Yeah, that would be a good reason to get mad, I feel. Yeah. So we're here to talk about your new book, The House of Shattered Wings. Do you want to tell folks a little bit about this particular book, and then we can kind of dive into some of the meaty bits?
Okay, sure. The House of Shattered Wings is set in an alternate Paris, where basically instead of World War One, there was a kind of big magical apocalypse war that happened between different magical factions, and that basically nuked the entire city, so that even 60 years afterwards, people are still picking bits and pieces of spells out of the river and trying to avoid certain areas of town that aren't exactly savory. And it's the story of a particular magical faction, House Silver Spires, which was founded by Lucifer Morningstar, the first of the Fallen Angels, because this is a world where Fallen Angels are not exactly commonplace, but loom pretty large. And so this is the story of this magical faction and how they basically tried to survive in a very hostile setting.
So that's one of the first things I did want to talk about, because it is an alternate version of our world, but yet it also features some very familiar, I don't know if trappings would be the right word, and a lot of these spoke to me as an academic who spends far too much time reading depressing books about post-colonialism, because this is a book where colonization still occurs in very dramatic fashion, and which your main character is essentially a victim of, because he is taken away from his native home. And if I recall correctly, he's originally from Vietnam, and is taken away and sent to Paris, where basically he can never return. And I'm curious, you know, how you thought of yourself kind of weaving this together, the sort of real world history with this alternate magical history and all of its mythologies and magical characters.
Well, I was trying to create a homage to 19th century novels. Now, the 19th century in France and in many other places is like a really, really big area of time, because it covers the Industrial Revolution, and it's a very apocalyptic century, actually, which is, you know, in France in particular, you had the Industrial Revolution, which meant that a lot of things changes, ways of life changed. Massive urbanization happened, that kind of thing. But you also had a lot of political unrest in France. It was just, it covers the period right after the French Revolution, and you have like an empire, two or three monarchies, a very short-lived republic, which ends when the guy who's the head of the republic decides that he doesn't really want to step down and that he would rather be an emperor. So Second Empire, and then the Commune, which is this weird bit of the history of Paris where Paris declared itself independent and it ended messily and bloodily on barricades. There's a lot of really interesting things that happened around that time period, and it's a lot of stuff that you really cover in a lot of depth in literature classes in French. And basically, I wanted to write a version of this, but with magic. And the post-colonialism, I mean, the entire thing that happened to Philippe is actually, I mean, dramatic, I'm not sure is the word that I would use for it, because it's entirely, unfortunately, historically accurate. There were people from the colonies press ganged in World War One and World War Two, and particularly in World War Two, they press ganged them into making ammunition for the front. And then because it was a mess, because they weren't really motivated, they didn't actually get around to repatriating those guys until 8 years after the war was ended, I think, or something. So they basically remained as indentured labor. They built roads, they planted rice in Camargue, they did all sorts of things for which I'm pretty sure they never really got paid or never really got credited. And nobody really talks about those things. So I kind of felt like I had to make a statement.
That's interesting. So, I imagine my particular period of study would be the British Empire from roughly the 1850s to the 1950s, and from there American Empire as well. And so, I would imagine a lot of these things would have happened very similarly in France. And I was very interested to see you bring a lot of that to the table. And I do think it's interesting that your main character Philippe is this figure whose past is known to him, but basically nobody else really knows his past. And part of the story is actually kind of unveiling how he became a victim of this very process you're talking about. And I do like that because, as you say, right, that there's this sense of erasure in the actual history. And that is something that this book is redressing for Philippe, but in the kind of the reverse, if that makes sense.
I made a very deliberate choice that I was going to center the narration around people who didn't actually get narration centered on them a lot. So, and I threw in Philippe because, well, insofar as colonial history goes, I'm very familiar with the colonial history of Vietnam and then a little less with like everything else, because a lot of we study in class wouldn't really, well, erasure is putting it kindly when it comes to explaining what France has been around to. Doing. And part of the whole storyline that I had going in The House of Shattered Wings was making sure that the center of the narration shifted around a bit.
In terms of you switched from a variety of different characters at in various positions of power.
But in a quote unquote traditional epic fantasy, the main character would almost certainly have been Isabelle. And that was something I got stuck on because I just couldn't make it work.
That's interesting, because I never got the sense that Isabelle should have been the main character, but I guess you're kind of right that in an epic fantasy that would be the expectation. Interesting. I hadn't really thought about that. Oh. Okay, well, I chew on that, Julia. Do you want to jump in?
Sure. So I think one of the interesting things about this world that's presented to us pretty much from the beginning and then gets more entangled as we go on is the system of houses that are set up in Paris and the way that they're run. And I'm just wondering if you want to talk a little bit more about them and about whether or not you base them on anything in real life and history that you've studied, or if they were just something you made up on your own.
Well, the base of the houses system is that after the war, Paris gets divided into those little areas that are held by magical factions, and the magical factions are called houses. They provide safety, they provide food, they provide magic, they provide like basic resources to their dependents and to a variety of people who are not formally dependents, so a little less protected by the house, but still get paid for a number of things by them. There's some historical things from the 19th century. Again, it is reminiscent of the big, I don't have the word in English, and I'm not sure there's a word in English. In French, it's called un hôtel particulier, and it's a huge household in Paris that was basically a very large family and hundreds and hundreds of servants for this particular family. But you had everything ranging from this to like very, very small households in the 19th century. So what I did when I made up the house system was exacerbated in the sense that you would mainly have the houses needed to reach a certain critical mass in order to be able to function. And those that didn't basically got taken down by the others. You never really hear about the ones that didn't make it. So that was pretty much the inspiration. And then obviously, you know, I based it on some French aristocracy. So they all have colors, they all have a coat of arms, they all have a particular way of doing things because it's their philosophy, which, well, I don't know, it seemed pretty natural to me.
Okay, that's fair. So we have this big sweeping sort of landscape on which we're drawing this drama. Well, I say we're, but actually it's all you. We're just reading it. And I'm wondering, how hard was it to keep track of all of that? Did you have like a Bible that you referred to with all of the different details of what was going on in different parts of the city?
I had two things. I had a map, which was mainly Île de la Cité, which is the main location of the novel, and I basically printed out a Google map of the area, and then I drew on it, like, this piece is not so much where events were happening, but like what the geography of the place was like compared to the real world geography of Île de la Cité. And the second thing that I have is what I call my character sheets, which is actually, that makes it sound a little less than what it actually is. It's a detailed list of like every house, every person in the house that gets mentioned in the narration, and things that get mentioned about them. Physical descriptions, if they have partners, who they're partnered with, that sort of thing. I did this because I realized about half, I didn't do it from the beginning of the book, but about a third of the way through, I realized I had to let go of the book for a while, and then I realized I had no idea how a particular character could be physically described, and I completely messed up their hair color, and I was like, oh Jesus, I really don't want to have to go through that in copy edits. So I'm just going to straighten things out.
I can imagine. It just seemed like such a... It's such a large cast, and it really does feel like the city is teeming with people, which is neat, but I also wondered how on earth you kept track of all of that, because it does seem like an awful lot to keep track of. So talking about the kinds of magic that are used, it seems to be that the main kind of magic that's used in Paris, at least, is taking bits and pieces of the bodies of these fallen angels, and those are inherently magical. Is that, like, how did you come up with that? And also, it's kind of gruesome. Ugh, how did you sleep at night after writing it?
I watched an episode of Bones. It must have been something like 5 or 6 years ago. And it was, I cannot for the life of me remember what the episode was about. But towards the end of the episode, the character played by David Boreanaz, Booth, confronts a woman who's been stealing from a hospital and sawing into bone, into rib cages, and says something about bone dust being corrosive to lungs. And I thought, hey, that's neat. And I wondered why you would inhale bone dust. And I thought, hey, because it's addictive, it's a drug. Okay, so why would you inhale that drug? Well, in a fantasy setting, it sort of felt natural to me that you would inhale it because it gave you magic. And then because I have a lot of trouble imagining a magic system until I have a really good idea of where it's coming from and what the background to it is, I thought, so why is it magic? Well, it's magic because it comes from something that was magic, or someone, since we're talking bones. Oh, I know, angels. I sleep pretty well at night, actually. yeah, no, I mean, a lot of it is like, it's basically it's fiction.
I really hope so.
No, I do not have an angel in my basement. Like, my basement is really
Elliot
boring.
Is secretly going to come to our houses and strip away the flesh from our fingers and then grind our bones into dust that she will inhale.
Oh my god, that's horrifying. This just went from it's a fantasy novel to it is another, like Silence of the Lambs kind of thing going on.
It's really more Silence of the Angels, though.
It would be Silence of the Angels instead of the Lambs, yeah. Oh, goodness, that's pretty terrifying. But, I mean, so the gruesomeness that Julia is remarking, I mean, you don't go into a whole lot of detail, but it does kind of appear very early in the book that because the bodies and the various bits on an angel's body, a fallen angel's body, do produce magic, that means when angels do fall and they're found by people who are not from the houses, oftentimes they're carved up because their bits are, I guess, a little bit more potent when you for example, cut off fingers, which is pretty gruesome, but also seems like a natural consequence of a city, as you describe when we first started this, right, as a city that's basically gone through, you know, almost like an apocalypse. It's just everything's kind of horrible there.
Well, yeah, to me, I mean, it's a resource scarce setting, which means that people have to do things to survive, and generally the things that you do to survive tend to be not very pleasant. So it felt to me pretty natural there, you know, if there was something which was worth a great deal of money, and if there was something which would bring people a whole lot of power, the sad truth of history is that no matter how gruesome it is, people will do it. And will actually often find excuses for actually making it seem morally worthy, which is even creepier. See, that, however, prevents me from sleeping at night.
Which is completely fair. So I think that's really interesting that this month we've interviewed two authors about books that have a lot to do with flying and wings and bones. And I'm wondering, have you had a chance to read Fran Wilde's Updraft yet?
Yes.
It's completely different, but yet you guys both have the theme of wings and bones all throughout.
Yep.
Did you know that before you started hers?
Not at all, actually. I read hers 3 months ago, I think, or something. And
wow.
And mine got started 3-4 years ago. But I knew she was working on a novel, but I had no idea what, and that didn't entail flying. I didn't know about the bones until I actually read her novel.
I mean, they're completely different. There's really not much that I can say about them that's the same, except for that and the fact that there are multiple women with interesting character arcs. Which, I mean, as far as things go to have in common, that's a pretty good one.
It's a fairly different tone, yeah.
So, speaking of the women, you do have a lot of different female characters in your cityscape, and with varying degrees of power and varying degrees of agency. And you say that in any typical fantasy, Isabel would be the main character. But I think that I'm not even sure if there is a main character. If there is, it's probably Philippe. But really, it feels more like it's just an ensemble book about the city and the houses and the great trauma that is about to be visited upon them. And I'm wondering, did you deliberately set out to write a lot of women in different positions of power, or was that something that just came naturally to you?
Well, originally they were all women. So my husband then talked me into adding a man because he felt it would be fairer. And I mean, I actually thought there were a lot of women, but like, if you actually count up the cast, it's about 50-50. Even though the main characters being women sort of skew that. But to me, it felt pretty natural that you would have, I wanted two things. I wanted like women in positions of power because you don't very often see them, and yet they exist and they do that very well. And the other thing that I wanted was definitely across, like, I can't do complete cross section with like three points of view. That's impossible. But like a reasonable spread of characters across all social levels. So you have Selene, who's the head of the house and pretty much at the top of the hierarchy. You have Madeleine, who's about halfway through the hierarchy of the house. She's not a servant, but she's not exactly a high flyer either, and actually not very competent at her job. And then you have Philippe, who's basically off the map, being a complete outsider. And if there was a bottom tier of the system, he'd be somewhere there.
Well, right, because at the beginning of the story, before he gets sucked into that house, he's actually just part of a street gang of mortals. Which brings up another interesting thing, which is that you have the system of the city is in complete disarray after this magical apocalypse. So, of course, you have the magical factions that have their own houses, but you have, it seems like, all of the humans kind of banded together in their own groups for protection, which are different gangs. Did you base that on anything that you read in history, or was that kind of something you also came up with on your own?
Well, I mean, it's something that occurs in history, but I can't point to anything. I mean,
I guess I'm asking because you said that there were some things that you thought were really interesting about the history of Paris around that time, and I'm unfamiliar with that time in Paris's history, so I wasn't sure if there were specific Parisian street gangs.
Yeah, no, I mean, there were bands of roving children around that time. They're described, for instance, in Les Misérables, the band that Gavroche forms, which... I mean, it was a harsh set of times, basically. And so children and young people would band together in as a way to survive and probably not roam the streets like a pack of wolves. That's my personal dystopian take on it. But it certainly was inspired by stuff I read in books. It's also... it comes pretty naturally in the sense that all the fallen have to be inside houses, otherwise they're not going to survive because they need to band to be powerful together to be powerful, and then they take the favored with them, the favored humans, so that pretty much leaves other humans to organize. And again, I mean, the gangs are like very much the bottom bit. You have people who are not part of gangs and who are just trying to live a quiet life, and who don't, you know, who don't set out to commit such deliberate violence.
So in your version of post-apocalyptic Paris, is it possible that there could be someone who was just managing to live a quiet life? Because I wasn't sure based on how tumultuous everything was. I wasn't sure how possible that was for a regular person.
Well, I mean... quiet for a baseline of quiet, which is not the one that we currently have. I mean, it is very close to a perpetual simmering war zone, so people go about their lives as best as they can, but things do flare up.
Yeah. I did want to just say that I'm not sure what's more terrifying, the idea of fallen angels being hacked to pieces or roving street gangs of children. Because that sounds really horrifying to me. But what Julia was talking about with the position of humans in relation to the fallen, we do actually have a counter to that in the figure of Claire, who is not a fallen and yet leads one of the houses and is described at one point in the book as engaging in charity and the like for, well, I guess everyday human people. And I was wondering if you, I mean, did you kind of construct her intentionally as a kind of opposite to, say, for example, Selene?
I function a lot by opposites, so partly yes, and partly because it seemed a little too facile to have houses that were exclusively headed by fallen, because that would have meant, like, you know, and I hate things that are too tidy, So to suggest that the entire upper class society of Paris of that time would have been fallen angels didn't feel right to me, which is how I came up with Claire. And the other things I was trying to do with Claire was that older women frequently get dismissed as not being efficient. And my grandmother's come through two world wars, a famine, and well, actually two famines. And when I look at her, what I mainly think is, okay, she's lived through all of that. What makes you think that she's not competent? And it is some of what I wanted to capture with Claire, which is if you get to be that old in a position of power, it pretty much means people shouldn't mess around with you. And a lot of people constantly underestimate her.
Yeah, I recall a particular scene, the first time we're introduced to Claire, for example, where I think it's Madeline and Philippe, and there's one other character there, and Claire shows up, and every kind of gesture she makes with her face, every word that comes out of her mouth is something that the other characters kind of have to analyze, because there's always they always assume there's an agenda there, because they don't underestimate her. They know that she's
no.
up to something.
Well, some people got the warning.
Yeah, exactly. And even if they don't understand what the warning is, right, they just know there's like a hidden thing in what she said to us that suggests that there's something more going on here.
Yeah, but later on, Madeline doesn't remember that when she goes to Lazarus.
True. True.
Yeah, I don't want to get too far into that for fear of spoiling the book for people who haven't yet read it, but it's definitely the sort of thing where I think you work really well with playing with that line of sort of like the archetype of Jessica Fletcher, where you get somebody. She's the star of Murder, She Wrote, and she's always solving mysteries, and people are constantly just dismissing her as a little old lady, and so she's clearly not important, except that she's actually the one solving all the crimes, and she's watching everything you do. And I see that happening a lot with Claire, where she is sort of like, she looks grandmotherly, and she seems like she could be nice, but you really actually need to watch your back, and it's easy to forget that.
Yep, and she goes around with the pack of children, just, you know, to go with the image of grandmothers.
Mm-hmm.
I love Claire.
Yeah. It seems like everything she does is very carefully calculated to project the image that she wishes to project.
By now it's become a survival skill again. And Lazarus is a very particular house in the sense that their motto is divide to reign, very much. When you're a minor house and you're not very big, you're headed by a human, and you don't have tens of thousands of fallen, you mostly count on other people forgetting you. Well, not forgetting you so much as thinking that you're the lesser threat compared to other houses who are more showy.
Yeah, and I think that's an interesting part about Claire, like what Julia was mentioning, with the first time we see her, she's surrounded by children, right? Is this it disarms you in a way, because, well, what kind of evil person would hang around with children, right, and have a gaggle of kids following her around at a market? And it forces that expectation, well, at least forces that for people in the book. I think hopefully people, when they first see that, will think, this character's up to something.
Well, everyone's up to something.
This is fair. Everyone in the book is pretty much up to something. That's true. That's true. I do like Claire as a character, because she's so much different than everyone else because of necessity. She has to be much more calculated, I feel, than some of the other characters perhaps do at times because of the expectations. Yeah. I'm sorry, I didn't have a question there. I was just saying how much I like Claire.
So...
That's
on,
allowed.
On Twitter, Paul said that he was on a different team. Did you expect people to be taking teams of the different houses when you started this?
No, but that was really funny though. No, and I I didn't expect people to be on this particular team either. Though I guess if you have to pick one, it's a pretty good one.
I mean, just from the sake of being protected?
Pretty much, yeah. Being on the right side, you know? We will nuke everyone who's not on our side. Okay, fine. I'm on your side.
I, for one, welcome our new overlord.
Out of curiosity, which house would you want to be part of?
I kind of feel like I have to be Team Morningstar.
Fair enough. He's kind of a big character. Yeah. Okay. All right. I'm gonna use this to analyze you one day. Don't worry. This is a very
Okay.
important detail. Heard it here first, everybody. Aliette de Bodar would be part of House Silverspires.
So I have a question about the rest of the world, because clearly the fallen angels are falling to Paris for sure, but are they falling in different places, or it seems like there's a hint at least that magic works differently in different places. What is the picture overall of the world at this point?
Well, you have fallen angels mainly in Europe and areas of strong Christianism originally, except that something called colonization happened, so they kind of spread. And with the war cutting off communications, they're now still in their colonies, probably. But in other parts of the world, you had other kinds of magic, other kinds of folklore being coming into play, and there were some pretty ugly magical wars happening during colonization.
So, is the magic that happens in other places based on the prevalent religious beliefs of those areas?
No, it's a bit of a mix of everything, really. I mean, it's not prevalent. It's like religious beliefs. So, like, Taoism is not the prevalent religion in Paris, but you can still have Taoist magic functioning there.
Okay. So, but the default magic in Paris is going to be grinding up angel bones if you can find them.
Well, it's because it's a dominant,
Right.
both numerically and, well, for historical reasons, also the dominant power.
So I kind of don't want to spoil too much about what happens and which characters are revealed as what, but I do want to ask a little bit about how you approached the mixture of things that you brought to this, and like whether it was personally significant to you to tell this particular story in the way that you did, which I think we got a little bit into earlier, but I'd love to hear a little bit more about it.
I mean, part of the reason that I wanted to have all those magical systems happening at the same time is because, well, again, I don't want things to be too tidy, and I especially don't want to get into a theological debate about the moral superiority of fallen angels over everything, because that gets really messy really fast and really problematic. And the other thing that I'm trying to do is, I feel very strongly about dominant positions in Erasure, and they currently have a lot of ads in the Paris Metro about the Museum of Immigration, and one of their slogans is "Our ancestors were not all Gauls," because when I was little, they used to teach in school something that started with "Our ancestors, the Gauls," and it doesn't matter when you're 6 years old, but when you're 30, you're like, hang on, no, they weren't. And part of what I wanted to do was show that even in a place like Paris, even in a place that is completely dominated by the prevalent system of fallen angel and houses, there are other things exist, other things survive, other things can even thrive for relative values of thriving in this universe, of course. And you have pockets of different things, of different people. A case of, we've always been there, hi.
Yeah, that I think that's great. And in that way, in some ways reminded me a little bit of Neil Gaiman's American Gods, which is a very different book, but also takes that same sort of the people who live in this place and their beliefs affect the magic that is there.
Hmm.
Which I think is a neat idea, and I think it also helps when you remember that, no, our ancestors were not all X or Y. They were very many different things because people move about quite a bit.
Yeah, and another aspect of that too is, and we're talking about the, you know, colonial empires, they were bringing people back. And those, yep. Right? And like, what happens to those peoples if we're not talking about all the people that had come back from wherever they came from whether, you know, Northern Africa or Southeast Asia or wherever. Yeah.
Mm. Well, and you also had people, which is something I had no space to address in the book, but like in colonial empires, the colonist culture is being declared as the superior culture. So managing to send your children, for instance, to a French school in Vietnam was highly prestigious. And even more so to be able to send your children to a French university in Paris. And in Paris, they would, of course, still be second-class citizens. But it didn't matter because it was better than what other people got.
Yeah, and you get the same kind of idea that happens in the British Empire. I study the Caribbean, and a lot of the authors that I'm studying from like the 19th century, they went to England to get an education, and that was considered... Right, you didn't get your full education in the Caribbean, often because you didn't have access to it. It was kind of a high class thing. You were an upperclassman in your grouping if you went to England to get your advanced education. So it's that same idea. And then of course a lot of them never came back. They stayed in England. And some of them did come back and.
But even today, I was having a chat with Stephanie Salter, who's from Jamaica, and she was saying that, you know, being able to speak English that's relatively close to the UK standard is being seen as being of a higher social class than someone who speaks closer to Patois, the local Patois.
Yeah, that's a huge problem as well, and it has had an impact on... Well, it has an impact on how much research has been done historically on the development of, say, for example, Creole, and also on whether or not people actually speak these. And it also creates the issue of, is it called code switching? I think is the term. The idea that you switch how you speak in different situations. And in the Caribbean, sometimes what that means is how you talk to, like if you're in Jamaica, how you talk to other Jamaicans will be drastically different than you talk to somebody who appears to be, like, I don't know, from America or wherever. I think Nella Hopkinson has actually talked about that a little bit, but I can't recall. And I think Tobias Bekele did, too, and he wrote a post maybe a few years ago where he talked about going back to, I think he went back to the Virgin Islands and how that stuff started coming back to him, and he realized how much he had actually kind of lost it because he lives in Ohio where he doesn't meet anybody from... anywhere in the Caribbean on a regular basis. I mean, it's Ohio. So, yeah, it's a very interesting thing, that historical element and how it has continued to impact culture even today. And the one thing I did want to talk about, though, on this, very much related to this idea, you actually deal with this notion of knowledge and how... colonization sort of affects what knowledge we actually take back with us, or keep in the, I guess, the national lexicon, as it were. Because there's a moment in the book where you have characters trying to figure out who Philippe really is, and the realization that these people who are French, the knowledge they have access to is fundamentally inadequate, because essentially the French Empire showed up and pushed all of the sort of local mythologies, the local magic, as it were, out of the dominant position of power. And there was, by implication, there's no attempt to really kind of collect the information about it to sort of understand what it is. And that creates a problem because they're trying to figure out who Philippe is. And they're like, yeah, we've got like some random notes in some books, but it's inadequate. It doesn't fulfill the information. And it's kind of this weird moment in the book where it kind of feels... like the irony of colonization is like really brought to the fore, I think, in that moment. And I was wondering if that's kind of something how you were kind of looking at creating knowledge in the book as a way of kind of rebuffing some of that, the sort of background of colonial history in the book.
Well, if it is a subconscious, I mean, I wasn't aware that I was doing it. The books that they look at, a lot of them actually exist. It's a very different thing to read a book that was written by a French colonist, and an actual Vietnamese person. I mean, the Gulf is, especially beginning of 20th century, very, very wet. I have this book called I can't remember what it is, but it's like a primer on Vietnamese history, which excerpts various sources on various time periods. And some of those colonist accounts are just, wow, so completely, I mean, at the time it must have seemed perfectly natural. However, with the benefit of hindsight and 90 years on, more than 90 years on, actually close to a century on, wow, they sound like people trying to make sense of a conversation that they heard through glass.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Thick panes of glass.
Yeah, I've experienced that same thing. There's in England, there is a historian named James Anthony Froude, who is infamous for writing this book about the West Indies, basically during the period when the British Empire is starting to consider whether or not it wants to keep the West Indies and keep paying for it. And he goes down there essentially with the agenda of saying, like, well, I'm going to defend the empire, why its role needs to be there. And what he ends up discovering while he's down there is only the things he wanted to find, as he cleverly reinterprets everything that happens to him into an example of the inferiority of the local people. So there are these moments, for example, when he sits in his carriage and is being driven down the street, and he just looks in people's doorways and he makes all these vast assumptions about what they think and who they are. I call it drive-by anthropology, basically. And it's really absurd. And there's even a really horrific moment when he's like near a pond, and there are some women gathering water, and you know, they're carrying the water on their heads, and he imagines almost like a hallucination that they are trying to seduce him while getting water. And it's all about this idea that native women, they must therefore be highly sexually active, and that they could be a danger to the good Christian man. And it's his like deep-seated fear is affecting his ability to even see, like, no, they're just getting water, and they're just making fun of you in their native language because you're staring at them while they're getting water.
Yeah. I mean it's easy to laugh about that kind of thing, you know, 90 years on, but yeah. I distinctly remember when I was, it was back in 2012, I think, and I took my husband with me to Vietnam so that he could meet the rest of my maternal family. And on the plane, I was reading this guidebook about Vietnamese customs. And I was like having this great moment of dissociation of like, what? This is just, I mean, and it's, you know, it's not like as wildly off as some of these accounts were, but it's still off. It's like placing emphasis on like the wrong things, misunderstanding some things, and this very much, you know, I'm not saying that cultural barriers are like impenetrable, but just that a lot of people seem to be totally unaware that they do exist and just go blithely explaining things as though they were experts in them, and like go like, okay. And it's, I mean, it's very, very different. When I was learning Vietnamese, I mean, my Vietnamese is like, as a child, is very poor because it's mostly limited to food and members of my maternal family. And I tried learning it, well, I am still learning it as an adult. And I got one of these books from the library, which basically was teaching a Westerner how to speak it. So all the pronouns were off. In Vietnamese, like, the choice of pronoun is paramount because it gives the amount of respect that you're going to grant to a person. So if I speak to a person who's very much older than me, I'm going to call myself child or grandchild because I am the very youngest person. And if I don't know, I should use the third person because it's the polite thing to do. what they were telling you to do in those books were like, look, it's simpler. You just have to use toy, which is the pronoun for I, but it is the equivalent of standing up and down, waving hands and saying me, me, me all the time. And my husband, who learned Russian, told me that it's the same problem with the Russian books. And that, I mean, that really drove home to me the fact that there's different kinds of narratives about cultures and that you have to be very, very careful about ingrained bias that people are carrying and that, you know, I am carrying as well. It's not like this thing that happens to other people. And it's really insidious.
Yeah, that's a really interesting way of describing it, that the sort of insidiousness, the way it worms into us without us even noticing. Well, at least until the moment when you look and you realize that maybe it is kind of
hopefully at some point.
Yeah, hopefully you figure it out. But, I mean, it can be really hard to realize. I mean, if you think, like, I mean, I'm an American, so, and so is Julia. As far as I know, Julia is American, but, you know, who knows? You could be from another world. And I mean, thinking about, you know, how we're influenced by the way our media portrays anything that isn't in the United States and outside of the United States, and wondering the line at which, like, when does that begin to affect my interpretation of events, even if I'm aware that it's affecting me, and whether or not, how aware can I even be of how that's affecting me? And that's kind of a really horrifying idea that you may not even be able to suss out when you have been negatively affected by a bias that you didn't even know you had.
I tend to use the expression, you know, the air you breathe, which is really, really hard to see.
Oh, that's great. Yeah.
It's definitely true. And it's actually interesting. This morning, I was watching a Swedish video that Nina Orms linked to on Facebook, which was a man named Hans Rosling, who basically, my Swedish is very, very basic. I'm just starting to learn it, so I really don't understand a whole lot of it. But basically, from what I can tell, he was telling this person who's like a talk show host that, you know, yes, you can't trust the media because everything that you think you know because the media has taught you that in every other place in the world, you know, girls don't go to school, and there's all kinds of other stuff that's horrible, and they don't tell you anything about what's actually happening in different places, and you have no real picture of what's going on in the rest of the world. And I thought that's something that's really interesting and good to keep in mind, because we are all steeped in our ideas that are just kind of given to us everywhere we go about the rest of the world, and they're not necessarily reliable at all.
Yeah. I don't remember if everyone remembered the Reza Aslan controversy from, well, I think it came from like either early this year or late last year, and then there was more of it this year. Maybe not. But I remember him being in an interview because I think it was something bad had happened in some country which is predominantly Muslim. I can't remember what the scenario was. It was like Syria or something like that. And they brought Reza Aslan on because he's now famous for being the religious scholar who studies the Old Testament, who is a Muslim, and that on Fox they made a big deal about it. Like, why would a Muslim care about Jesus? And he's like, well, because I got a PhD in religious studies, so it's like my job. So, like, duh. But in the interview that they were asking him, and they kept saying that Muslim countries are all like this. Muslim countries do this. They all, like, women don't have rights in all the Muslim countries. And Aslan kept hitting them and saying, no, you're not understanding. The problem I have with what you're saying is you're taking like dozens of countries with billions of people, or a billion or however many there are, and saying they're all alike and forgetting that like each of these countries has their own individual issues and that they're not all isolated to quote unquote Islam, right? That some of them, their issues are much more complicated than just a religion being evil. Because that's the frame, and I think this was like CNN, which is supposed to be the quote unquote centrist news network in the United States, but they kept trying to get him to admit that over and over, get him to admit that all the Muslim countries are the same, and he's like, no, you guys don't understand. And I remember they brought up like female genital mutilation was the thing they brought up, and then he sits there and he names off countries that are predominantly Christian that have even greater issues with female genital mutilation, and his, and basically, like, they just ignored him. They just pretended anything he said, like, they all the words just went over their heads because they had an agenda to set. And it was really, I found really, really frustrating because it's impossible, I think, to have any discussion about any complicated topic when we can't actually admit that we're dealing with facile understandings of what's happening. Does that make sense? So, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, I think it's also an artifact of particularly TV journalism, which doesn't leave a lot of space for actually going in depth on anything, unfortunately.
That's true.
It is the culture of, you know, even if it's not the sound bite, there is not as much you can do with TV as you could with, say, a proper article in a newspaper.
Yeah, and there's the problem, too, is will people actually read the long, in-depth analysis versus
Probably
the
not.
Sensationalist version, which is, I think, in part a commentary on our contemporary culture, which is we're very happy to have our reality TV shows that are shocking and the drama is manufactured for us. But are we willing to actually address the complications of real-world dramas where the things aren't manufactured? They're complicated and messy, and the answers are not black and white.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, it's... I mean, I cringe every time someone tells me, but it's just fiction. Why do you care? And I'm like, duh. Fiction is, you know, the stuff that gets built in your mind and called up to deal with the real world. That's my problem.
Yeah, it has a huge impact. That's a problem. I hate that answer. Like, oh, it's just fiction. What does it matter? And it's like, well, but you, like, it's like you don't have any understanding of how fiction has helped shape the world. Literature has a dramatic impact on everything from national consciousness to identity to all sorts of things. But, well, this isn't exactly something taught in high school, as far as I know. We don't have long discussions about the impact of literature on the world.
No, not in French high schools either, let me reassure you on that. Unless I missed it, but I don't think so.
They certainly didn't have it in my high school. I mean, there may be like that one weird high school that's really cool, but you never know. But anyway, we got really far from the book.
So I was just going to bring it back. I think we should really probably start to wrap up, but I do have one final question that is kind of a burning question. And that is that the book ends in quite a dramatic fashion, but also with some possibilities for more continued stories in the world. Are there more stories coming?
Well, I have signed on for a further book, so I should hope so. Which is a sort of sequel to this one, and which is going to be focused on the House of Hawthorne.
Ooh. So Paul will be excited.
Yeah, I should guess he would be.
I love Paul.
Have you started writing that one yet?
I'm at the research and brainstorming stage, so I have about half a plot, and then I need to come up with the other half, basically.
Okay. Well, we'll look forward to that whenever it comes.
Someday. It'll be here someday, Julia. Don't worry.
It will be. Then we can get into more political intrigue among the magic factions of Paris.
And there's a couple short stories as well. I'm going to have one in Grimdark magazine. There's one that's coming out in Yanni Kuznia's Fantasy Medley 3. And there's another one which is a bonus, so maybe with the mass market, I'm not too sure.
Wait, you have it in the medley number 3? Really?
Yeah.
I think I have that book. I think they sent it to me. Oh my god,
I guess you'll need to pull it out and read that story then.
Oh, it's over there on the shelf, I think. I think they sent me they sent me something I remember, like Fantasy Medley, but I don't remember if it was number 3, but it has to be.
Has to be, because number 2 came out quite a number of years ago, so if it's a recent copy.
Oh, hell yeah. I've got some fun times. I just got really excited. Sorry. I didn't notice it was in there. So that's cool. Awesome. Awesome. Well, what about other, I know off podcast we talked because you've got a story that it may be out by the time this episode drops, but you have a story coming out in Asimov's, as I recall.
Yeah, I have a novella coming out in Asimov in the October and November issue, which is called The Citadel of Weeping Pearls, and which is basically more Vietnamese intergalactic empire.
Yay.
And it's a sort of loose sequel to On the Red Station Drifting, the previous novella. It's
awesome.
About the same length. so like big. That's why it's in the double issue. And it's also the cover story, and then there's some pretty good cool cover art that goes with it.
Right, I saw that cover art. It's really pretty.
It is really, really, really stunning.
Out of curiosity, are you writing any novels in your space universe?
I have one on the back burner, but like I need so much research and planning that it's still languishing somewhere on the back burner. At some point, I might just do. I was thinking of possibly doing a fix up with 4-linked novellas, but again, it's a bit of a daunting prospect. So we'll see.
Okay, all right, but at least you're thinking about it, so that makes me happy. So that's awesome because I love that universe a lot. So. What else? Do you have anything else that we should know about that you got coming out?
I'm going to have one in... I wrote some tie-in fiction for a game called Maelstrom's Edge, which is this galactic war game with figurines, and I wrote a story associated with that. And I'm going to have a piece in Athena Andreades's To Shape the Dark, which is about an aging biologist who's facing moral dilemmas, and which was partly based on the history of epidemiology in the 19th century, which incidentally is really fascinating.
This is touching on the subject that we talked about with Fran in the first interview we did with her at ICFA a couple of years ago. When we ended up talking, we had a long conversation about the book, The Ghost Map.
The Ghost Map.
I don't know if you've read that one.
Well, yeah, I read that one because it was recommended to me. So I really liked it. And I also read the biography of the guy who made the vaccine against...
Yellow fever?
Not yellow fever. The Black Death.
Bubonic plague.
Yes, so there's a really interesting history of the vaccine again, and how they figured out what yellow fever was. The scientists who had the theory that this was actually a mosquito-borne virus and let themselves get bitten by the mosquitoes that they thought were infected with it.
Oh my god!
Yeah, in a controlled environment, but some of them did die, and they basically, you know, they knew what they were doing, and they were like, but we believe this is it, and we have to prove it.
Oh my god. That's... Wow. Like, so they intentionally put themselves in a position where they could very well die.
They captured mosquitoes that they thought were carrying it, and, like, basically trapped them against their skin, like, under a glass until they bit them.
Whoa.
Oh my god.
Although I will note that the guy who made the bubonic plague vaccine started off by testing it on himself. So... It was like some pretty wild experiments going on.
Seriously. Just you gotta have respect for the scientists of yore.
Well, yeah, because, yeah, wow.
Have you read The Calcutta Chromosome? I can't remember. It might be against, it's malaria, I think?
I haven't read it, but it sounds like something I'd be interested in.
Yeah, it's a novel. It's by Amitiv Ghosh, and it's not really about that, but that is a large story in the background. And I think it's about like a scientist, like one of the characters in the background is the guy who found a medication against malaria. And so there's a huge part where he actually tests it on himself and his assistant and that sort of thing. I was like, ooh, 19th century medicine.
Wow.
Making sacrifices.
That's some bravery. Kudos to them for those people that figured that stuff out and put their lives on the line to do it. So
yeah, I also think like just people who are willing, especially nurses, to be with sick people, especially in times like in the 19th century. I was just recently reading the history of Boston City Hospital, and that was started in the 1860s, I think, and was just supposed to be the place where everyone who didn't have the means to be treated elsewhere could go. And the history of it that I was reading was written in 1904. That was mostly like a doctor reminiscing about the first 40 years of it. And then like some other primary source sort of eyewitness, you know, this is what I remember happening type things. But the doctor who's the main writer of it has one section where he lists all the people who died working in the hospital and like the date that they started and the date that they died. And a lot of the nursing candidates like would start and die within the first year. Were the first 6 months. But the thing that I thought was really telling, in a kind of like, oh, really way, was that he said, well, we think the reason why so many nurses die so quickly is because they get lax about hygiene and they just think they're invulnerable. And I thought, that's really interesting that you, a doctor who doesn't have to be in constant contact with these patients and cleaning their bodily fluids up, would say, oh, it's the nurses getting lazy about hygiene, and not, in fact, like, they're just in contact with that stuff all the time. Because if you sign up to nurse somebody, you're signing up to actually clean up all of their grossness.
Wow.
So I thought it was interesting that the doctor's perspective was, like, basically those nurses got lazy about cleaning up after themselves, and not, in fact, they're, like, touching people all the time.
Yeah, because goodness yeah. knows, like, that would probably be the number one reason you'd get an infection.
Right. Well, yeah. my respect for nurses of the 19th century is very, very high at this point, because just, like, seeing the numbers of how many of them died and how soon after starting they died. And it's like that they would list the diseases they died of, and it was usually, you know, something that we don't really see now, like smallpox or something like that.
Yeah. Wow.
Diphtheria was a big one.
No fun. Yeah. Well, okay, so we got a whole bunch of awesome stories to look forward to. Are there any conventions or anything you're going to in the next few months that people might want to know about?
I'm going to be in Milan for Strani Monday, October 10th, I think. The weekend of October 10th. Then the weekend after that, October 17th, I'll be in Manchester and London for the Golans Festival with a whole bunch of other Golans authors. So lots of things to check out. Then I'm taking a little bit of a break, and then in towards the tail end of October, I'm going to be at Utopial, which is one of the main science fiction conventions in France, in Nantes. It's October 31st, November 1st, I think. And the weekend just after that, November 6, 7, 8, I'll be in Amsterdam at the American Book Center for something that Tim and Svan is launching, which is EsherCon, which is me and Richie Dolan and Reason, Tade Thompson, Bill Campbell, Zen Cho, Maria Kinishkamp, and Corinne Duvis doing stuff, basically.
Awesome. That just sounds like an awesome group. I hope you guys have a ton of fun. That sounds great.
We're bunking together, so that should be fun.
Well, for international listeners and any Americans who may be traveling abroad, you've got some things to look forward to. There'd be plenty of options. So, well, I think that we got to, like, go away now.
Sad. Okay.
That's so sad. Julia, why do we have to leave?
Because we can't spend all of our lives on Skype.
That is a fair argument. Well, so thanks so much, Aliette, for coming on and talking to us about The House of Shattered Wings.
Thank you.
It was a very fun read, and thanks, Julia, for being my co-ninja host on this.
I don't think I'm a ninja, but I'm happy to co-host.
Okay, you want to be a sorcerer?
If she doesn't want to be a ninja, I'll take a ninja.
It's more likely that I would be a sorcerer than a ninja. I'm aware of my level of coordination and acrobatic expertise, and I don't see ninja happening in my lifetime.
So co-sorcerer, then.
Co-sorcerer is more likely.
All right. Well, thank you, my co-sorcerer, Julia.
All right. And on that note...
Awkward ending and scene. If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google Plus.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
Just another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet. Force will be with you. Always.
This is Ripley, last survivor of the Nostromo, signing off.